Howdy.
Hey.
What's up?
Nothing.
I'm a quiet talker now.
Yes, we're also very close.
Very, very close.
We're sharing one mic right now.
Ooh.
Two guys, one mic.
And we're in bed. That's a little erotic. Ho, 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 baby. You know, this recording volume on here says it's low.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it maybe because we were just whispering?
I thought so, but no. We're only hitting a 12.
Oh,
I'm gonna turn up the volume, folks. So it's gonna blow your eardrums. Oh!
That's bump it up.
I bumped it up just a little bit. I think that's good. So Spencer, more publishing news.
Woo!
I'm sure you're excited to always hear publishing news from me. So my publisher, one of them, Dark Homes Publishing sent me the cover. Well, working on the cover for the anthology I am in, and the name has changed.
Mm-hmm.
I already forget what it was before, Veil of Terror or Nightmares or something. Well, it's no longer that. Now it is Ethereal Nightmares, an anthology of twisted tales. What do you think of that?
I do like that as a better name.
And you can actually see the cover, which is cool.
Yes, it's very nice.
If you want to actually see the cover yourselves, folks, by the time this episode airs, I think it's already up. But right now there's a cover reveal in 5 days, I believe.
Woo!
So yeah, that'll be out. If you follow Dark Home Publishing, you can check that out.
And I'm sure once it gets announced that we'll share it and stuff too. So
yeah, I'll put it on the internet for everybody to see. Speaking of stuff on the internet for everybody to see, I also got my press packet from Mad Axe Media because we got a lot going on for that one. That would be readings from Cursed Room 301, 16 Tales of Twisted Horror Tropes.
Oh, no.
Caleb's Story, The Haunted Pillow, a.k.a. The House of Shit, is in that collection. And a lot of people have submitted to that, so the fact that I got in makes me happy.
Yeah.
I got The House of Shit.
Right.
And in the table of contents.
It hasn't.
It says House of Shit, so... That's going to be released in July 2024, but the press kit I got is for the Kickstarter.
Ooh.
You hear that?
Yeah.
When is the Kickstarter going live? It doesn't say on this. I think that announcement is actually going to be made soon. I'll have to keep an eye out. But if you folks go on, again, Instagram, at CalebJames1986, I'm sure I'll already have posted about it. If you give money to the Kickstarter, I get more money.
Yeah.
I would appreciate it. So if you ever wanted to donate to DPW but didn't feel like it, you can donate to the Caleb Fund by giving money to this Kickstarter, because the more money it raises on Kickstarter, the more the authors get paid for their stories.
And you, with Delta, I'm assuming...
One help the, cover the cost.
Cover the cost, but also ensures the customer a copy of the book.
That as well, and also I think there's tiers in the Kickstarter, so like after a certain amount of money, they'll have an audiobook version.
And probably they'll probably have like a hard and soft cover that's normally pretty...
Yeah, so give them all the money, and then we can get cooler stuff. Because at least the cover that I see looks pretty fucking neat. It's got fire.
Fire.
Yeah, I got lots of fire.
Burning rings of fire, fire, fire.
The... Oh, I got burp.
Get it out. Yeah.
I'll just throw up. Strange Day Zine, at least as of the recording of this, I have not seen anything about the being published yet. You can pre-order Volume 14, but it has not, as of now, been announced as released. So maybe they're just waiting on the printers. I'm assuming that's what it is, because he said way back in March, in a couple weeks, it was going to be out. So I don't know. It says I always got to wait for shit, you know. Oh, he's fucking waiting. I'm also waiting still for The Siren's Call to put out that issue, but that's a spring issue, so I feel like a lot of these are going to come out in May.
Yeah.
Like, The Dark Home is supposed to be released in the end of April or early May. I was surprised, because when I initially submitted, it said summer. So they seem to have pushed the scheduling of the anthology ahead, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all the news I got. Do you got any news?
Still waiting on the Diabolical Press information.
I've given up on that. I'm assuming that's never coming out.
At least you got a copy.
If I get famous, that'll be one of those things where it's like, hey, the most rarest of the rare.
Yeah.
Caleb has a story in Diabolical Press issue 1. One and only. I don't know. I don't know if he's going to fucking do something with it or not. He has not announced anything ever, and he stopped posting on the Diabolik Press Facebook or Instagram. So
yeah, because I've seen your copy. Like, you know,
it's cool.
Yeah, well, I would like to have a copy of my own.
I mean, I can let you read my copy if you're supervised.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to have the white gloves on. And
you ain't dirtying up my copy with you stick your fingertips. What was the other thing? Oh, the thing we submitted to, still haven't heard anything.
No.
But they haven't announced anything either, so I don't know if it's one of those deals where they just got behind.
Right.
Or if we're ignored.
Well, again, like we said, we didn't know if the 2 weeks was supposed to be 2 weeks from the day that we submitted it or 2 weeks from the submission period ending. So,
which was the end of March.
Yeah, so if it's that, we still have a little bit of time.
Yeah. Regardless, I would be very miffed if I got a no reply.
Yeah.
I do not like those. You've got a couple of those, I think. At least one I know of. Diabolik Press. Mm. And I don't think it's very cool to just not reply to submissions. Right. If it was one of us, I could be like, maybe they went in the junk mail or they didn't. Actually, I don't think it's possible. This was like an online forum. But regardless, I think it's not cool. But if one of us didn't hear anything, I'd be like, okay, maybe it was a goof or something. But if we both don't hear anything.
Well, because there was that one As Alive thing. Is that the one where we both submitted to and we
rejected at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't read the stories, I don't think.
No, but still, they at least
got back to us.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. If you get your submissions filled and you don't need them, just say that. Yeah, I think it's what As Alive pretty much did. It's like, oh, I didn't need them.
Yeah.
I mean, they got full. Whatever. That's fine. Happens. But if you go ahead and ask for these submissions and then you get... Somebody has the fucking 20 minutes of going through all these guidelines and bullshit and formatting, and then you just don't say anything? Kind of a dickhead.
A little bit.
Kind of a fucking dickhead. But that's all I got, so listen to the episode we are about to record after these musical introductions.
Mm-hmm.
By the Dave Matthews Band. My vagina hurts and it's leaking real bad. I took a dump in the toilet and now I'm sad. I never listened to Dave Matthews. I have no idea what he sounds like.
Not like that, I believe so.
I mean, I've heard Dave Matthews, but it's like one of those things where it's like people love Dave Matthews. Yeah. Like, oh, don't know what the fella looks like. If I saw him, I'd be like, is that Dave Matthews or is that
he's
like...
He's very like normal looking.
Yeah, he's just a dude, right?
Yeah, he's just like a middle-aged, like kind of chubby white guy.
I mean, he even has the name of just a middle-aged chubby white guy.
Yeah.
We are live. Patreon only episode.
I was going to say, can you hear the crowd?
Both of those things were lies. All of those lies. But you are listening to the Drunken Pen podcast of lies.
And deceit.
And deceit. I am your host, Caleb James. With me, as always, Spencer, the Kalamazoo colon kisser church.
Aw.
Gross.
That is gross.
I was going to say clutcher, but like you used to get in there to clutch that thing.
I thought he was going to go with Crusher.
Yeah, I thought about that, but that's not you.
No.
That's not you. You're not. If anything, you're getting the colon crushed.
My colon's getting crushed.
Oh, for sure. Smashed it. Like a fucking, like that stupid Titan submersible that went down to see the Titanic and just implosion. That's your colon. Today we are talking about Might and Magic, how to write a sword and sorcery tale.
Ooh.
This is from David Costello over at Servescape.com. I'm only going to read a part of the actual article, mainly just some of the topic headings.
Okay.
This fellow went hardcore on the sword and sorcery, but also I don't know if this is from a modern perspective of sword and sorcery because...
Or like more of a classic.
Well, I'm just saying I don't read modern sword and sorcery. I don't even know if people write modern sword and sorcery or if it's just based off of I love sword and sorcery from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, so I write like that. Like, I don't know if it's like most genres where it has turned and been bastardized into something unimaginably garbage.
How you feel about that, Caleb?
Give me a cramp in the rib. Ah! Oh, I think my pancreas exploded.
Oh. You're fine.
Oh. Oh, Jesus. It might have had something to do with that workout today. We fucking did a bunch of random shit on the floor. Yeah, none of that sounded good, did it? Don't think of gay butt sex people. That's not right.
No.
They don't call you the colon kisser for nothing. Can you name your favorite
colon?
No. Can you name your favorite sword and sorcery writer or ones you've read?
I'm going to say it probably would have to be Howard.
Robert E. Howard, the founding father.
Just because of he's probably the most that I've read of, you know, of anybody probably.
Isn't it crazy how, like, Lovecraft pretty much invented the cosmic horror genre? He didn't invent it, but he's known as the main, like, the granddaddy of it.
Yeah.
But Howard, I think, might have actually invented sword and sorcery. Because there was fantasy before him, but I don't think sword and sorcery was any, like, a genre at all.
Yeah, it's probably more kind of token kind of fantasy, you know.
Or even, like, C.S. Lewis or something. But sword and sorcery, which I probably should explain, is about swords and sorcery.
Yeah.
It's more adventure-based fantasy rather than, like, these grand world-building series and, you know, crazy magic systems. A lot of that is glossed over for actual adventure, which I like. And sometimes you want some head cleaving.
Yeah.
A lot of head cleaving. So, yeah, Robert E.
Heart punches.
Heart punches, I would say, is appropriate. Yeah. Heart punches. Something's going on there. So, yeah, Robert E. Howard's the OG. We also have one, Fritz Lieber. You ever read Fritz Lieber?
No, I have not.
He is credited with coining the term sword and sorcery.
Okay.
Not Howard. Howard never used the term that I know of. So he widened the scope of the narrative style through his intelligent and philosophically charged stories of Fahrd and the Grey Mouser series. F-A-F-H-R-D. Fahrd. Another one, which I might like more than Robert E. Howard, is Michael Moorcock.
Yeah.
As you know, I'm a big Elric Melniboné fan.
I figured it may probably be, like, written better.
Yeah. Moorcock, well, it says here, so he ventured deeper into the psyche of the heroes. He has a lot more layers to the characters. It's not just, oh, Conan, buff and strong, and he pillage and murder. No, a lot of his characters, some of them are even weak, but overcome their weaknesses. And actually have character arcs and developments, where Conan's a lot of just, you know, slashing and stabbing. Also, what I like, the dilemmas, I think, are more dire in Moorcock's work. Like, there's a lot of, fate and morality.
Do you ever worry, and maybe you don't because you know it's a longer series, but, like, when you're reading it, be like, oh, the main character might not make it to where, like, when you read, like, a Conan thing, you're like, well, Conan's going to at least win.
He always wins.
If he's dying, he's taking the person with him, at the very least.
But and then he never really dies, does
he? Well, I can't remember what happens in The Old Man when he's like, because he gets like stabbed.
Yeah, but he's old, so it doesn't matter then. He lived his whole life. That's another one, since the very first, I believe, first Conan story was Old Man Conan.
Yeah.
Every other story that follows, you're like, well, he lives.
Yeah.
He's always going to fucking live. He's old man. Never start with being old unless you want the reader to feel there's no stakes in any of the stories. But that's a character, like a Robert E. Howard character. They seem to never die.
And also with that too, like there's a good chance that like a lot of people probably didn't read that first story at first. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With the way that how the stories were published, you know?
Yeah, so. That's true. Again, serialized. Moorcock's were novels for the most part. I mean, I'm sure he wrote short stories, but I've only read the novels. Next up, C.L. Moore.
So, I think that one sounds familiar.
C.L. Moore broke new grounds by introducing us to Jor-El of Jori, a female warrior navigating a landscape predominantly occupied by male protagonists, bringing forward narratives rich with symbolism and emotional depth. So I have not read any C.L. Moore. I have also not read Carl Edward Wagner. Have you read some Wagner?
No, I don't believe so.
So he's known for the Kane series. Which brings a darker, often horrific edge to the adventures, portraying a troubled anti-hero with deep psychological complexity. I notice one thing about sword and sorcery that gets overlooked is the literary merit of it. Even the goofy Conan stories, I would say, are more literary than pulp, at least from what I remember us reading. The final one of note, the authors of note here, Clark Ashton Smith. Smith added a poetic and cosmic dimension to the narrative style, weaving complex tales that often transcended the boundaries of sword and sorcery, venturing into realms of science fiction and horror.
So that seems almost like if you took like the Lovecraft and Howard and kind of like merged them together.
Well, fun fact, Howard has written a bunch of stories in the Lovecraft universe.
And didn't Lovecraft do the same? Because they were buddies, didn't they? They shared... Because like I remember in some of those... Conan stories, they're being like, you know, like Cthulhu-y kind of like monsters, you know.
Right.
Or like Elder Gods, like, you
stuff
know.
Stuff like that, yeah. So where sword and sorcery splits from regular fantasy stories and adventure stories, it's a more person. You're breathing into the mic. Stop breathing into the mic. That's all I hear is you fucking... Stop breathing. Stop fucking breathing. You die. You go die, and then you come back when I tell you to. Yeah, so the stories in sword and sorcery usually are more personal. So you think of like the Elric of Melniboné, it's you know, King Elric and his personal quest. Conan, it's his personal quest. Whereas you think of Lord of the Rings, yeah, it's the, you know, Frodo and the his little guild there, but it's always like a bigger implication in those stories. It's not just, oh, what's going to happen to Frodo if he doesn't throw the ring? No, it's what happens to the world if he doesn't get rid of the ring. So the sword and sorcery, it's usually like, I'm going to save a princess, and if I fail, maybe the princess dies, maybe Conan dies. Like, it's not world ending usually, you know? So here are some of the subtopics you will find in sword and sorcery that you might not find in normal fantasy. Revenge quest, Spencer.
I like revenge.
Again, remember, personal. Lower your expectations. These aren't revenge quest that's got to save the day for the whole world. No, these are personal stories. So, yeah, a protagonist embarks on a perilous journey to avenge a personal wrong, navigating through treacherous landscapes and facing formidable enemies, all driven by a deep-seated need for vengeance. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. Stealing precious items is one that I see a lot in the Conan stories. Mm-hmm. He's always fucking climbing towers and stealing orbs and shit. Little crook. He was a pirate for a while.
Yeah.
I like Pirate Conan. Whether it's a heist plotted with meticulous detail or a spontaneous snatch and grab, narrative centered around stealing often involve high stakes, clever strategies, and the constant threat of being caught, providing a rich ground for personal drama and moral dilemmas. Before we go on, I do want to note that it's funny just from our readings. It seems that the sword and sorcery genre actually lines up with crime noir, the themes and the like, what the stories are actually about. It's like different genres completely, but same kind of stories.
Yeah, it's just like the settings are different.
Yeah, so you know, like you're saving a woman, or you come across the dame, or a princess. You come across a precious jewel, or
I mean, how many times has like somebody came to hire Conan to do a thing?
Yeah,
that's very private eye. Yeah.
Rescue missions is another popular one. So Conan, yeah. Again, just remember crime noir, Conan, these kind of stories. So heroes might find themselves on a mission to rescue a loved one, a reverend mentor, or a figure of importance, driving them into the very heart of danger as they battle against time and foe with an unwavering determination. The rescue missions have been adopted by video games a long time ago, and they're usually a pain in the fucking balls. Just want to say that. Search for sacred or forbidden knowledge. I always like this one because I feel like this always leads to more philosophical stories.
Mm. Well, and that's also too, like sometimes when you get like the weird, like, oh, I read this book, but it burned my eyes out kind of, you know, like that kind of stuff.
An adventure spurred by the protagonist's thirst for knowledge, diving deep into ancient ruins or forbidden lands to unearth secrets that are personal to them, bringing them face to face with unexpected challenges and moral quandaries. I like a moral quandary.
Just quandaries in general.
It depends on the quandary. Quagmire, that's a difference. I like quagmires, too. Survival against the odds. By the way, a lot of these I realize are in my sword and my sword and sorcery story, Asher Kang versus the Army of the Undead, which you can read in Dark Home Publishing, Ethereal Nightmares, Tales of Twisted Terror, or Twisted Tales, whatever it's called. That anthology has my long sword and sorcery story that was inspired by the Conan, because I wrote that when we read all those Conan stories.
Yeah.
I want to write more of those, but I actually have a lot of these things in it, so I'm glad I was on the right track just
without even
knowing
realizing
any of this. Yeah, just from reading. So if you just read a lot of sword and sorcery and you're interested in writing it, that's probably enough.
Probably,
to get the gist of, like, you'll find yourself doing the right things more often than not. But yeah, so the survival against the odds. Narratives that depict a protagonist's fierce battle for survival, perhaps stranded in a hostile environment or pursued by relentless enemies, underscoring their cunning resilience and the personal growth that comes from facing and overcoming such trials. Such as my story, where Asher Kang finds himself after having been in a battle where two armies were completely wiped out and he was the only survivor. The armies came back as the Draugr, the undead, and he had to fight him a second time.
Hey, spoilers, yeah.
Well, I didn't give any spoilers, but the tagline for the story is he's facing down the army of the undead and he has to send them to hell a second time.
Yeah.
Cool story, I'm telling you right now. And he's got a big old sword. Yeah, it's actually, I call it a slasher. It's curved. It's curved. Oh, yeah. So he can decapitate. Personal redemption. A hero grappling with a dark past undertakes a journey for personal redemption, seeking to atone for their mistakes through acts of bravery, facing their inner demons, and striving for a personal sense of peace and self-forgiveness. This seems to come a lot in the Moorcock stuff I've read. Rites of passage. Young protagonists undergoing rites of passage, facing a series of trials and challenges that test their courage, wisdom, and skill, a journey to prove their worth to themselves and community. Interesting.
I know you haven't watched or read any of it, but what do you think, like, the Game of Thrones stuff falls into that? Because, you know, like, they have, you know, this...
From my understanding, the Game of Thrones is more along the lines of Dune, as in it's, like, almost political.
It is very political, yeah.
So I don't think that would count. And also, I think things are on a grander stage, as far as my understanding. I never watched the show, so I don't know, but isn't it, like... Not just, oh, if this family does something wrong, they
oh,
get
yeah, there's
up.
Multiple, like, warring factions, and yeah.
All right, so this gives some examples of different works of note in the sword sorcery genre. So The Swords of Lankmar by Fritz Lieber, and this guy definitely just put letters together for his title. In this tale, we venture into the grimy underbelly of the city of Lankmar with Fahard and the Grey Mouse, or terrible name. Rather than engaging in world-altering battles, the duo navigates political intrigue and personal vendettas, weaving a tale that explores the depths of friendship, betrayal, and cunning as they plot their way through a world rife with deceit and secrecy and a bunch of other nonsense. That actually makes me think that maybe Martin was inspired by Sword and Sorcery and has elements of that in Game of Thrones, because it does sound like Game of Thrones, other than the fact that, like I said, it was on a larger scale, yeah. But it is also a lot of just, like, personal things with the families, right?
Yeah.
So it's just, I think, actually, it's probably just multi-plots. So it might just be considered close to Sword and Sorcery.
Or maybe, like, like modern Sword and Sorcery, probably.
Perhaps. Elric of Melniboné by Michael Moorcock.
There you go.
This installment in the Elric saga brings us into the sphere of Emperor Elric's personal turmoil. Wrought with moral dilemmas and a tragic narrative arc that encapsulates loss and betrayal, Moorcock crafts a poignant narrative focused on Elric's internal battles and choices, painting a portrait of a hero burdened with deep personal flaws, navigating a world steeped in gray morality. I like his story, and you know what's cool about Elric? He doesn't look like a Conan. He is tall, albino, kind of skinny, and he has to always give himself pretty... It's almost like he has diabetes.
Yeah.
Like, he has to take some kind of herbs or something, or he gets weaker and weaker and he would die.
I would say, does he... Because, like, just a little bit, from you talking about him and stuff I've seen, he always kind of reminded me more of a Solomon Kane than a Conan.
Solomon Kane's still busting heads like Conan.
But he wasn't, like, he didn't have, like, the build and stuff, though, right?
I think Solomon Kane is Ned Flanders.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know when Ned Flanders takes off his shirt and you're like, good God. Yeah, he's a lot of the corded rope, like his muscles are corded ropes, and like he's wiry, but he's pretty rough.
Honestly, because I've only read some Simon Kane like comics, yeah. So I wasn't sure.
No, he's definitely busting some fucking heads. The Broken Sword by Paul Anderson. I don't know if his name is misspelled because it's P-O-U-L or if that's how he spells it. But Paul Anderson, in this narrative, Anderson focuses on the personal vendettas and inner turmoil of the tragic hero Scafflock, a changeling raised amidst elves. So this is like harder fantasy.
Yeah.
Even against the canvas of a world rich with Norse mythology and epic battles, the story maintains a piercing focus on Scafflock's personal journey, filled with betrayal, loss, and intimate confrontations and a bunch of other stuff. So this might be more up your alley just from our readings. Morally ambiguous heroes. So who's a morally ambiguous hero? What characteristics do they have? Well, for one, self-preservation. Yep. I'm thinking Conan for these.
Yeah.
Because Conan, when you actually read the story, he's like, oh, he's not like a hero. He's the barbarian.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, he's saving people, but he's a barbarian.
Yeah, they're only by coincidence of him saving himself that they also get saved.
Yeah, Robert E. Howard was a proponent of barbarism, which I think we talked about on the Conan episodes. So where he sees modern civilization and going to court and hashing things out through dialogue, he thinks it's boo hockey. Is that a word? Boo hiss? No, yeah. That ain't the right word. Bull honky.
Yeah.
Bull honky is what I meant. I don't know what boo hockey is. Boo cocky, I think, is what I was thinking of.
I wonder why.
But the verbal bukkake going on in courtrooms did not appease Howard's barbaric nature. He liked the man who could throw down in fisticuffs.
Which is kind of funny because he was always like, wasn't he always kind of like on the smaller kind of like sickly side? Like, wasn't he all...
No, that's Lovecraft. Howard was a boxer.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he got down and he did some fighting. Him, he could have been sickly. I don't know. He killed himself pretty young, but he was a fighting man.
Mm.
He's a Texan. I don't think he was sickly. Lovecraft was sickly and morose. And gross.
Gross.
You ever see his face? You can tell he had bad teeth. Okay, so some characteristics of the, what did I say? The morally ambiguous hero. Self-preservation. These heroes prioritize their survival above other moral considerations, sometimes leading to morally questionable decisions. Complex backgrounds. They often come from backgrounds laden with personal tragedies or controversial histories, which shape their complex personalities and views on the world. So if you think of modern people who usually stand-up comedians, a lot of the good ones had very fucked up childhoods.
Yeah.
Usually the more tragic the background, the more sympathetic and endearing the hero comes about. So you could almost, like a Deadpool even, it's like, oh, I feel bad for Deadpool, so even though he does horrible shit.
Well, I was just going to say, like, most superheroes, shitty.
Shitty, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't say Batman. I know you're thinking it. Don't say Batman.
Spider-Man.
Nah, it's not that. It's his uncle.
But, I mean, his parents died before that.
Yeah, but he didn't know him. Did he? He didn't know him. Depends on who's telling the story. Willingness.
He also lives in Queens, I mean.
Yeah. Willingness to employ violence. Yeah, but he lived there before it was gentrified, technically.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not modern Spider-Man, but that's because they just stopped aging him. Willingness to employ violence. These heroes do not shy away from using violence to achieve their ends, often showcasing a ruthless, even brutal side, again, the barbarian. Manipulative tendencies. They're gaslighting you, Spencer. That's what they're doing.
Yep.
They're making you think it's your fault. The reason that they hit you.
Yeah.
Because your mouth wouldn't stop running, and you hurt their feelings, so they had to close it for you.
And then I headbutted their knife.
Yeah. Oh, what Howard, in the Steve Costigan stories, what Howard's been saying a lot is I love where he'll be like during the fight or just whenever, it's like, I stopped the fist with my nose.
Yeah.
He always makes it so like, I stopped the fist with my eye. It's like, my eye stopped his blasting fist. Like, I just love it. It's like, why is your eye doing the action? So it's like, no, he didn't get punched. He fucking stopped it with his face. I just appreciate that. But anyway, these characters might manipulate people in situations to their advantage, revealing a strategic and cunning mindset. Moral relativism. I don't know what this one means necessarily, so let's read about it. They may exhibit a form of moral relativism where their sense of right and wrong is flexible and situational. Okay. I like that most of these are just like, oh, no, he's like how real people are. This is just basically just be real people. Personal ambition. A deep-seated personal ambition drives them, sometimes overshadowing their moral judgments. Internal conflicts. They frequently battle internal conflicts torn between their desires. Basically, anyone's not Superman.
Yeah.
That's all this is. Good characters. So who are some of the characters that inhabit these traits? Not inhabit, but who have these traits? Number one, Conan the Barbarian by Robert E. Howard. Everyone knows Conan, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
He is a barbarian.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Black hair, blazing blue eyes.
Yeah. I think something with a crow. Maybe his hair was color of crow feather. Something like that. It repeated every fucking story. Elric, oh my God, the Steve Costigan stories. Every single story, even when he doesn't get in an official boxing match, he has to say his height and weight.
Oh, yeah?
6 foot, 190 pounds, and his opponent, 6'1", 230 pounds.
Isn't that crazy, like 190 pounds, like back then? Like
heavyweight.
That's a big guy.
He was a heavyweight. But yeah, every single story, it comes up. Like there was one where he fought off the Chinese mob. There was really no boxing. I mean, some boxing went on, but he was just punching people out. But he still had to give his height. He's like, he was a big Chinaman. He was like, well, I'm 6 foot, 190 pounds. And he had to be like, why do you have to give you're always having to give your build, height, and weight in every story. I get it. It's because these were all printed in fight magazines, like boxing magazines at the time. I'm just like, every fucking time, Howard, you got to give the height and weight. And the guy never gains weight, ever. Never loses weight. He's always the same. One story, in the middle of the stories I'm reading, so I'm like almost 200 pages in. I read half the stories. One story, they changed the name of his dog to Bill.
Oh, yeah?
Went from Mike to Bill, and they changed the name of his boat from the Sea Girl to the Panther.
Hmm.
It's like, why the change? It was like a different publication. It's like, I really want to investigate, like, why the change, just one story? Because the dog's a big element in the stories. Like, Mike is Bulldog. It's like just as, you know, popular as he was.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, Elric of Melniboné by Michael Moorcock. He got a cool sword called Stormbringer, and it's cursed. I think it sucks the souls of the ones it kills.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's all you need to know. Kane series by Carl Edward Wagner. And that's all. That's all of them.
That's all?
No more. No more. That's the morally ambiguous one. But now we got magic-wielding antagonist with a personal vendetta.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot. Here, we'll speed some of this up. I think we're supposed to be teaching people how to write this stuff. Yeah. I don't think that comes up.
So, but we're giving them some of the building blocks, the things to check out.
Yeah, yeah. So if you want to write a magic-wielding antagonist with a personal vendetta, here's some characteristics you can utilize to make them more realistic. Revenge for a personal loss. That's simple. Somebody killed their daughter, and they're going to revenge.
You also talked about it earlier in the article.
Yes. Betrayal and broken alliances. Now, this is a unique one. Nursing grudges from betrayal and seeking to exact revenge, which results in a complex web of deceit and treachery. Not just because WrestleMania was this weekend, but I just want to say wrestling utilizes all these tropes.
Yeah.
The revenge for personal loss, betrayal and broken allegiance. The next one, ideological conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So you got IRS trying to collect his money.
Right.
And then you got, you know, I don't know, Doink the Clown who doesn't want to pay his taxes. Like, there's some ideological conflict there.
There is.
Went early 90s because I don't know what I don't think they do tax stuff anymore.
No.
Next up, historical grudges. Yes, you know, you killed my great-great-grandfather with your great-great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. He stopped his fist with your punching nose and saying stupid stuff. Personal rivalries is one. A lot of old school, even before Sword and Sorcery, a lot of old chivalrous works were about families feuding.
Mm.
Defending honor is a good one, and retribution for perceived injustices. So if you want some examples of that, you can read Legend by David Gemmell. You can read the The RIYRIA. How would you say that?
That's fair.
The Riria Revelation series by Michael J. Sullivan. Riria? Riria? It reminds me, SNL some years ago did a skit with John Mulaney. He was supposed to be a guest on a game show hosted by
Bill Hader.
Bill Hader, and it was guess that name. And then like he brings out, I think it was like one of the bridesmaids, and he's like, "We know you don't know her name, so we'll give you the last three letters." And it was like ARA. And he was like, "Here's a name." And he's just like, "Mara, Dara, Wara, Sara." He just kept going. And then eventually he was like, "No, it was Mara." And he's like, "I said Mara." And he's like, "Yeah, but you didn't know it." So yeah, that series. The First Law trilogy by Joe Abercrombie, and that's all for those. Companions who aid the hero. So your Sancho Panzas. This is we're bringing it old school.
Or Bill the Dog,
yeah. So what do companions who aid their heroes need to be good characters? Let's find out. Complementary skill sets. So they need to have knowledge that complements the hero's skill set. So Sancho Panza and Don Quixote were a goofy pair, but they did complement each other. And since then, the hero and his sidekick have been a trope.
Yeah.
Ever since. So you think of Sherlock Holmes and Watson, and then in Sword and Sorcery or Crime Noir, it's always the same deal. Whatever the hero lacks, usually the sidekick has, and vice versa. And also they have skills that combine and they can do cool shit. Mm. Moral dilemmas. So through interactions with the companions, heroes often find themselves embroiled in complex moral dilemmas, and usually that's the person who helps them out. And then personal challenges. Companions often have their own set of challenges and usually their own subplot lines that they go through, and then sometimes they need the hero's help. Sometimes they're completely devoid of the hero. They do it on their own.
I was going to say one of the things that they didn't bring it up was like a good, like a plot point of being like, oh, this person needs saved.
Yes.
You know, from the actual main character.
So some examples, like in the Elric of Melniboné series, Elric is often in the company of Moonglum and other companions who bring diverse skills and moral perspectives to the table. The Witcher series by Andrzej Sapkowski, Geralt, you know, the protagonist, he interacts with characters like Dandelion and Yennefer. Yennefer. Is it really Yennefer?
I don't know.
Taco Leaf for kisses for my bin. My name's Yennefer Lopez. I like tacos and burritos. Classic episode. The Broken Empire trilogy by Mark Lawrence. Horg Ancroft, the main character, is surrounded by a group of companions. Okay, this is not even naming them. Romantic subplots. What do we need for a good romantic subplot? I'll give you three things, all right? Does that sound good?
Boobs, butts,
vagines. Vagines. Significant influence on the narrative. Obviously, it pushes the narrative forward. Oftentimes in Sword and Sorcery, the reason for the story's existence is because of the romantic subplot, or I guess it would be the main plot. I gotta save the princess, or I fell in love with this girl and she was kidnapped. Usually those are the simple ones. Passionate love. Same difference. And tragedy, which usually is loss of love. Yeah. So, you know, romantic stuff. And again, they give The Witcher, Conan the Barbarian, different sword and sorcery stuff. Don't do that.
Hey! Get out of there.
God darn dog.
That should be kept in.
Maybe it will be. Don't go over there again. Action and adventure taking center stage. If you want the action and stuff to take center stage, you need high-stakes scenarios, dynamic character arcs, and concise yet rich descriptions. The rich descriptions is the biggest part of the sword and sorcerer for me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these stories aren't just sword fights, because that would be you have to have reasons for the sword fights. But when you do the sword fights, you're not just cleaving heads. You're cleaving them to the fucking white meat. You know, you're spilling blood. You're caked in gore,
cracking teeth,
eyeballs are popping out, skin sloughing up on blades. You really get into the detail, because that's what people want to read. And obviously, the dynamic character arcs and stuff like that is pretty simple. This is a long fucking article, so I'm skimming through now. Mysterious and ancient magic. What do you need for good magic? A double-edged sword. It says.
Are you really?
In sword and sorcery narratives, magic often possesses a dual nature, serving as a source of... Okay, we get it. Moral ambiguity, quest for knowledge, transformation and metamorphosis, artifacts and spells, magical creatures. Good Lord, go to the show notes and read this article for yourself. Medieval settings is another popular trope of sword and sorcery, though I would be interested in reading a sword and sorcery set in futuristic space times.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I actually distracted myself because I just thought a feudal Japan sword and sorcery story would be fucking badass.
Yeah.
Because usually it's medieval, like, Europe settings. Or, like, the Conan's, the Hyperborean Age, which is basically set on, like, medieval Europe and Lord of the Rings type of stuff.
Right, yeah.
But, like, I would like a cool Japan. Or even, like, an African sword and sorcery setting would be different. Like, anything different I'm about. So, similarities and differences with other subgenres. Sword and sorcery versus high fantasy. Scope and scale, we talked about that. Character focus, again, you're going for sword and sorcery is more personal, whereas high fantasy, the characters are grander and all that stuff. Moral ambiguity, I can't say that word today. Fantasy, like high fantasy, often the characters, it's more good and evil, more black and white. Sword sorcery, because the characters are more realistic, it's more ambiguous. So it's like, hey, I killed this guy that didn't necessarily need killed, but he was bad, or he's a thief, and you know, whatever. Magical elements, setting, complexity of plot. Those are all the differences. Intersections with dark fantasy, atmosphere and tone, moral ambiguity, supernatural elements, horror infusion, complex narratives. What I like about sword and sorcery, it has a lot of horror elements, and it could easily be dark fantasy. I feel like it lends itself better to gritty, murdery stuff versus like regular high fantasy. Intersections with Lovecraftian horror. There's a lot of monsters in sword and sorcery. So cosmic entities, philosophical undertones, the unknown and unknowable, and psychological horror all are elements of both. And in conclusion, Sword and Sorcery is neato skeeto. You should read it.
Okay.
That was a long article. That guy did a lot of work, and I didn't want to read his article, you know, just to be a jerk, like read the whole thing.
You're right.
And I'm sure he didn't get paid for that.
Probably not.
So what do you think, Spencer? Read more sword and sorcery?
Yeah.
I like sword. It's become probably my favorite genre. Because it's like you could read it and zone out, and then it's just fun.
Mm-hmm.
I like the descriptions.
Yeah, that's the one thing. They normally do have pretty clever descriptions for things.
Sword sorcery often, at least the stuff I've read, often negates the boring parts of literary fiction. So, like, the stuff that makes literary fiction boring, they get rid of, and the stuff I like in literary fiction, such as the descriptions and flowery language, they keep.
So, outside of Howard and Moorcock, have you read any, like, much other sword and sorcery?
When I was a kid, I often got a lot of sword and sorcery books because of the covers. I couldn't name the authors.
What they were or anything.
Yeah, but I used to have a pretty big collection because my cousin owned a used bookstore next to my house when I was little. So I'd go over there and I would just get, because the covers.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a cool cover. And I would just buy them. That's how I got the Elric stuff originally, is because the covers were cool. So I used to just read a lot of the stuff probably from like the 70s and 80s or whenever those came out. And I don't really remember much of the authors, but I remember the writing is what stuck out to me. And ever since then, I like the descriptive writing. Anyway, that is our episode. My mouth has gone dry. I don't have a drink. If you like this episode, like, share, subscribe, rate us on iTunes, Google something.
YouTubes.
YouTube. The OnlyFans. Do you rate on there? What if you could?
It'd be cruel.
She gives me I give her a thumbs down. Not enough wrinkles around that starfish.
I give her a thumbs in.
Ooh, I give you a thumbs up and in. If you want to check out my publication, History, which is so big and thick. It's getting thick. You can go to CalebJamesK.com and I have links.
Links.
Just go on the tab that says publications, and I have links. And the ones that are clickable are the ones that are out.
Mm-hmm.
So you can click on those, and usually it'll send you either to the free version, or if it's something you have to buy, it'll send you where you can buy it. Or in the case of Diabolic Press, just send you their Instagram, because they never want to put the fucking book out. Spencer Church's OnlyFans. What is it?
I can't recall.
The Kalamazoo colon kisser.
Yep.
That's your OnlyFans. What are you doing?
We have to subscribe to find out.
Do they? It sounds pretty straightforward. The thing is, are the colons in the body or they've been removed? That's another dimension of ick.
That takes some digging.
It turns out he's actually just loves punctuation.
Yeah.
He's just kissing colons and semicolons. And what about exclamation parts?
Points. Fuck those motherfuckers. Fuck those guys.
Too extreme. So anyway, we thank you for listening. You can follow us at DPW Podcast on X, Facebook, and YouTube. And we will check you out next week. And eventually we have guests coming on again. But that's months out, I think. Thank God. So anyway, check you later.